Welcoming the New President. Story 1. One April morning in 1789, three little girls sat primly upon three haircloth chairs in Major Howell's parlor at Trenton, New Jersey. They were three Sarahs, Sarah Howell, Sarah Airy, and Sarah Collins, but they were better known by the name Sarah Howell had given them. "You, Sarah Airy," she said, "are Sarah A. I am Sarah B. for Sarah B. Howell, and of course Sarah Collins is Sarah C." This Monday morning, Sarah A. and Sarah C. had come to Sarah B.'s house to go with her and Mrs. Howell to the house of Mr. Armstrong, the minister. Mrs. Howell was not quite ready to start, and Sarah B. had just proposed a play. "Let us pretend that we are ladies, and that you are making a call on me," she said, speaking to both her little friends at once. And as the three sat stiffly down, she added, "We can talk about the new president, for all mother's callers do that now." There was a short silence. Then Sarah B. felt her responsibility as hostess and said with a grown-up air, "What a wise choice the electors have made in General Washington." That was a safe remark, she knew, for she had heard it many times in the past week. "Yes," agreed Sarah A., recalling a conversation she had overheard. "General Washington has saved our country. Now he will make our nation." "And how glad I am," quoted Sarah C., "that Trenton is to do its part in honoring him on his way to New York. How fortunate, too, that we have a poet in Major Howell." Sarah B. heard this last remark with a proud heart. "Of course," she thought, "it isn't proper for me to answer that." So she looked hopefully at Sarah A., who did her best to meet the occasion. "He is indeed a poet of dispute," she agreed airily, as became her name. "Oh, no, Sarah A., you mean repute," spoke Sarah C., forgetting the game. "Maybe I do," answered Sarah A. doubtfully. Then as she heard a smothered laugh from Major Howell in the next room, she became a little girl again at once. "That's a stupid game," she declared. "Why not play something else?" "There's not time, children," answered Mrs. Howell, coming into the parlor. "We must start this very minute," and the three Sarahs, joining hands, set out happily for the minister's. A few days before, General Washington, who had just been elected the first President of the United States, had started from his home at Mount Vernon for New York to take the oath of office, or to be inaugurated. He was traveling slowly, for it was before the days of railroads, and, besides, he was obliged to stop all along the way to receive the homage of a grateful people. The citizens of Trenton were not to be outdone by any other town on the route. They had decided that at the bridge over the creek where Washington had captured a body of Hessians, he should now ride beneath a triumphal arch. More than this, 13 young ladies and 6 little girls were to scatter flowers in his path and join their mothers in singing a triumph song. That song was the poem Major Howell had written, and this Monday morning Mr. Armstrong was to teach it to the ladies and their daughters. "The song goes very well," said the minister, as his visitors went home, "but I should like one more rehearsal at the bridge tomorrow morning." "I wish it were supper time," said Sarah B. on her way home to dinner. "This day goes so slowly." When Tuesday morning came, the first glimpse of the great day brought disappointment, for the three Sarahs looked out of their windows upon a dismal rain. "Oh, dear," said Sarah A. "Oh, dear," said Sarah B. "Oh, dear," said Sarah C., although not one of them had any idea that both the others were saying the very same thing at the same time. "But it is April," each little girl heard an answer. "The sun will probably come out by noon. Now we must hurry to the bridge." "The carpenters have finished building the arch," said Mrs. Howell on the way. "We shall have a full morning's work to trim it." "Are you going to let us help, mother?" asked Sarah B. eagerly. "You can help by carrying the flowers, perhaps," her mother answered, "but you are not tall enough to help much in the decorating." The weather persisted in being disagreeable most of the morning, but spite of the clouds, the women and girls sang the triumph song and trimmed the lofty arch. The little girls stayed a while to help, but after an hour or so they were told they must go home. Sarah B. almost cried at the command, but Mrs. Howell said decidedly, "You will be tired enough as it is, and besides," she whispered, "I know a great treat in store for Sarah B., if she is a good girl." The little girls took their sorrowful leave of the merry workers in the splendid arch. "Isn't it beautiful?" exclaimed Sarah A. as they stopped to look back at the arch, which stretched clear across the road and was supported by 6 pillars on one side and by 7 on the other. "Why didn't they make it even with 6 pillars on each side?" asked Sarah C. curiously. "Don't you know why there are 13 pillars? It is because there are 13 states in our country," promptly returned Sarah B. "And Mother told me what the decorations mean, too," she went on. "Do you see those pink and white flowers mixed with the evergreen that is twined about the pillars? That's laurel, and it's a sign that Washington was victorious in battle." "And are those festoons inside made of laurel, too?" asked Sarah C. "Yes, mostly, but I saw Mother put some other flowers with the laurel." "There's nothing quite so pretty as that blue and gold motto, though," said Sarah A. "I wish it were on this side of the arch so we could see it from here, but they want it where Washington can see it as he rides up, I suppose." "The letters are pretty," said Sarah B., "but I like it because it tells about us." "Does it?" said Sarah A. wonderingly. "I thought it was about Washington." "Why, it says, 'The defender of the mothers will be the protector of the daughters.' We are the daughters, you know, and Washington defended our mothers when he kept away the wicked British and Hessians before we were born," explained Sarah B. impressively. "And what's the sunflower for at the very top? Do you know that too, Sarah B.?" inquired Sarah C. "I know what Mother said. She told me it was to show that General Washington was the only son to give life and warmth to the body politic. Somebody called her away before she could ask her what she meant by body politic." "Well, General Washington will understand," answered Sarah A., "and the sunflower is handsome anyway." After a nap and an early dinner, the 3 Sarahs in stiff white muslins and holding baskets of flowers in their hands stood well to the front among a large company of women and girls waiting at the bridge for Washington's party. There were few men or boys on the spot, for Major Howell, Mr. Armstrong, and several other prominent citizens had gone to escort General Washington into the city, and most of the other men and the boys had gone too. The April sun had come out gloriously by this time, so that the hour of waiting was hot and tiresome. The little girls grew so uneasy that again and again they ran impatiently through the arch and across the bridge for the first sight of the procession. At last somebody cried, "Look! Look, there they come!" Somebody else said, "Children, get in your places," and it was scarcely any time before the 6 children, with their baskets of flowers on their arms, had scampered to their places by the roadside and were waiting excitedly. Nearer and nearer came the procession. Men on horseback rode first through the arch. Behind them were soldiers on foot. But it was the tall, dignified man who rode slowly behind the soldiers that people watched most eagerly. This was General Washington, whose wisdom and perseverance had done so much to make victory possible in the great war with England. As the hero approached, it seemed to the onlookers as if he was thinking, "Thank you," with all his heart, for as he rode slowly upon the bridge, he took off his hat respectfully. Just as he entered the arch, Mrs. Armstrong gave the signal, and the song began. Everybody sang the first lines. "Welcome, mighty chief, once more. Welcome to this grateful shore. Now no mercenary foe aims at thee the fatal blow." And then the girls finished the stanza alone. "Aims at thee the fatal blow." The girls began the next verse. "Virgins fair," and their mothers sang, "and matrons grave." Then all sang together, "These thy conquering arm did save. Build for thee triumphal bowers." Then the matrons sang alone, "Strew, ye fair, his way with flowers." And at the word, the girls scattered their flowers gracefully in Washington's path and finished the song themselves with the line, "Strew your hero's way with flowers." It was a most impressive scene, and no one there ever forgot how the simple tribute of flowers and song made the beloved general's eyes grow dim with grateful tears. "How tall and handsome he was," Sarah B. confided to her mother as she gazed admiringly after the procession. "And he looked good, too, if he had only said something." But though the modest general could not find voice to thank the little girls who had helped to give him one of the happiest moments of his life, he was even then planning how he might show his gratitude, and before he rode away from Trenton, he wrote this letter. General Washington cannot leave this place without expressing his acknowledgments to the matrons and young ladies who received him in so novel and grateful a manner at the Triumphal Arch in Trenton. The elegant taste with which it was adorned and the innocent appearance of the white-robed choir have made such impression on his remembrance as he hopes will never be effaced. Trenton, April 21, 1789. That night, three tired Sarahs took off their white dresses and sleepily recalled bits of the most thrilling day of their lives. But sleepy as she was, Sarah B. had a question to ask. "Mother, have I been good today?" "You know best, Sarah B., but why do you ask?" "Don't you remember how you said this morning that there was a treat in store for me if I was good?" "And so there is, dear child, but I don't want to tell you tonight. Tomorrow you shall know." Sarah B. was too sleepy to care much for the delay. She would know soon. Meantime, the blue silk curtains that hung around her bed appeared to change into an enormous arch, and her soft feather bed seemed a garden of fragrant flowers. She played and sang there all night. Story 2. Bessie Brandon was a pretty girl of 14. She lived with her father and mother on a plantation in South Carolina. It was a bright May morning in 1791, and the birds were singing in the big oak under which she sat. But the young girl was sad and almost ready to cry. At this time, the Revolution was at an end after 8 years of fighting. The 13 colonies were now the United States of America, and General George Washington was the first president. Now, this great and good man, whom all the people admired and loved, made up his mind to travel through the South. He wanted to see and to talk with the men and women who had borne so many hardships during the war. He longed to greet the many brave officers and soldiers who had fought so well and so bravely under Marion, Sumter, and Greene. The people of the South were much pleased to have this great man with them. Everywhere they came in crowds to greet and honor their beloved president. In some towns, arches of flowers spanned the road. In other places, young girls scattered flowers and wreaths of roses before him as he rode along the street. The morning on which our story opens was the very day that President Washington and his party were expected to ride through the town of Chester, about 6 miles from Bessie Brandon's home. All the family except Bessie had gone early. She was left behind to look after the house. Washington and his party rode in a large cream-colored coach drawn by 4 white horses. By the side of the coach, milk-white saddle horses were led along, to be used when the president was tired of riding in the carriage. Then there were men on the horseback who rode as an escort, besides a number of servants dressed in white suits with yellow trimmings. Behind the coach came the baggage wagon, drawn by 2 horses, and followed by an escort on horseback. "What a splendid time they'll have at Chester," thought Bessie sadly. "And Brother Obed is to make an address of welcome. Too bad, too bad." And this time she gave a sob as she thought of the scene, and herself at home all alone. How quiet it was, and it was only 9 o'clock, with the long summer day still before her. Suddenly Bessie heard the sound of galloping horses. It could not be the redcoats, for they had gone away long ago. A party came galloping down the road. In another moment a great coach drawn by 4 horses stopped at the gate. Servants in yellow and gold opened the door of the carriage, and out stopped a tall, fine-looking gentleman. Bessie had dried her tears and now stood on the piazza, looking with wonder at the tall, richly dressed stranger, who walked slowly toward the house and paused before the steps. "Good morning, little miss. Can you not give me some breakfast? I've had a long ride since sunrise, and I'm very hungry." Now, while Bessie was astonished at this request from a stranger, she was well-bred. She made a deep curtsy, as any well-bred girl of that time would do. "Father and mother have gone to Chester, sir, to see General Washington, and I am left to tend the house. I hardly know what to say." "Pray tell me your name, little miss." "Bessie Brandon, sir." And how old are you, Bessie? I shall be 14 next August, please. Well, Bessie, continued the stranger, taking a seat on the broad piazza, never mind if you were alone. If you will get me some breakfast, I promise that you shall see General Washington before any of your family do. Very well, sir, said her bright eyes, and her bright eyes began to shine. I will do the best I can for you, but our food is plain. Bessie was an excellent housekeeper. Her mother had taught her how to cook and to wait on the table. In a few moments the young girl had spread the table with snow-white linen and got out her mother's best china and silver. She prepared bacon and eggs and made coffee, and then with nimble feet ran to the spring for milk and butter. In a few minutes a meal good enough for the best man in the land was neatly spread on the table in the cool sitting-room. "Come, sir, your breakfast is ready," curtsied Bessie. "Ah, my little maid, you have done well. Do you please sit down with me, and I shall enjoy this good breakfast with you." The stately gentleman served his young hostess, and then ate with relish the plain but dainty breakfast. The guest was extremely dignified and sober, so dignified and so sober that I suppose Bessie was not sorry when the meal was over. When he had finished his breakfast and was ready to go on his journey, he bent gently down and kissed his little hostess. "Bessie, my dear, you may tell your father and mother that you not only saw General Washington before anybody else did in the city, but that you ate breakfast with him, and that he kissed you." Bessie Brandon lived to be an old lady. She often told of the day when she had the honor of preparing breakfast for President Washington, and of eating it with him.